Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
Oh, it's such a deep pleasure to be here, you know, with so many old, beloved Dharma friends and new ones, too, and just feeling the family way, the family resemblance, you know. Yeah, just delightful. And, you know, as I was sitting before coming in here, I could really feel Joan strongly present. You know, in a maybe a different way than I have before. Maybe more like an ancestor, you know? But a strong and bright and vivid and warm one, you know, not like something distant. But, you know, like she would talk about it, like somebody who's there to support your practice. You know, people you can rely on. And, you know, I could really feel the way that we're all relying on her and her practice and her ancestry as we're here together this week. And just that we can, you know, we can kind of fall back into that, which is just a lovely, I don't know, it's a lovely feeling. So this koan is really interesting and a little unusual in that it really invites us to take our vivid emotional life as a Dharma gate. That is the seat, can be the seat of our practice. And so we have this this woman who is grief-stricken, you know, and aren't we all, right? You know, everybody in this room is dealing with loss, everybody, and grief, and change, and uncertainty. And so often when we sit down to meditate, you know, that can be what's most vividly apparent, you know, to us, is our own suffering and the poignancy of that. And so her teacher was able to really see that her grief itself was not something to transcend in that moment, but it was something to actually completely become intimate with. And that was his instruction to her. His practice instruction is the heart of the one who asks is Zen. That's it. Your heart. You know? Your raggedy-ass heart. Your confused heart. You know, your upside-down heart. Your broken heart. That one. Yeah, that one. So, you know, it's kind of it's an interesting invitation. So I want to talk some tonight about the practice of the heart. What does that actually look like? What do we actually do? And really, what is the heart anyway? There's the sort of personal heart, the heart of the one who asks. But there's, later on in the koan, there's another heart that comes in, and that's the Heart Sutra. So I want to follow that transition from the heart of the one who asks, you know, your grief-stricken heart, to the heart of the Heart Sutra, and see what they have to do with each other. You know, I think for many, maybe most of us, a lot of our time in meditation is spent working with difficult emotional states. And especially early in practice, I mean, we can just, that can be the whole thing for years, maybe decades, you know? That could be the main thing. It's like a sort of like a karmic reckoning, all the things you've tried to run away from. You know, when you sit down and shut up, you can't really run away anymore, so you kind of have to just deal with it, right? So there's this sort of fire that we can need to sit with and find a way to be in relationship to. And that's the practice. How can I be in a skillful relationship to my heart? To the territory of my heart. And, you know, I think in many ways the fundamental move to working with emotional states in practice is to start to really, really feel vividly alive the energetic state of it, like the vividness, you know, the texture of it. You know, what exactly does it feel like? Can you get all the way inside of it? And at the very same time, can you drop your story about it? You know, the habitual story that gets attached, which is usually about how somebody is bad. Could be you, could be somebody else. You know? So, you know, we just start to notice. We notice these stories. It's just like a gnat that annoys you and flies around and doesn't leave you alone. But it doesn't make it true or real. And dealing with an emotion on an energetic level is a different thing from dealing with the secondary, you know, the secondary, right? The story that we attach. That's the suffering part. The story that we attach. You know, I don't deserve good things, or bad things will always happen to me, or I'm unlovable. You know, the certain certainties that we attach. So what we can start to do in our practice, and this is the heart of the one who asks, is to just simply be in the constantly arising and falling away energetic state of an emotional response. And as we do that, you know, things start to get a little bigger. You know, we find a little more space. We don't feel quite as closed in and terrified of our emotions. And that helps us to just have a different relationship to them. You know, as far as I can tell, and if anybody has a different experience, let me know, it's not like difficult emotions ever end. But it's really how can we relate to that in a way that doesn't perpetuate suffering for ourselves and others. So that's just the basic movement of working with the heart, you know, the practice of the heart, the personal heart. And there's no skipping that. That's the other thing, is I think a lot of us come to practice with the agenda of just transcending the messy business of the heart. You know, we want to just, you know, skip straight to Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi. You know, and get out of the muck, get out of the grief, the fear, you know, the rage. And this koan, this teacher really points us to going, you know, all the way in and through the practice of the heart instead of trying to skip it. And this is, you know, what we call spiritual bypassing, which is the tendency of practitioners to want to not do the difficult and messy work of the heart and the relationships, and instead to use spiritual practice as a way to sort of transcend the need to do that. So this koan is really an invitation to not bypass, to actually find the gate of the heart as a Dharma gate for our practice. And that's an invitation for all of us for this week. So as we sit with our emotional life, the most important thing, you know, is to be present without judgment and really to be noticing that story. And to really let it unfurl. It's like there's a feeling of movement about a real kind of unfolding emotional state. And can we allow for that movement? Can we just show up for that? And there's a feeling when we do that of a kind of a transformation. So it really becomes a transformational process. And it's a kind of alchemy. You know, back in the old days, they thought that, you know, the original alchemy was to turn straw into gold, right? So you take something that seems really worthless or difficult, and you can transform that into something that is incredibly precious. And when we sit in the middle of the hellfires, I think of there's a tanka with the hell realms, and there's a little Buddha sitting right there in the middle of the fire. You know, and sometimes it can feel like that in our practice. We're just sitting in the hellfire, you know, of a difficult, difficult state. And we're just in it. We're just in it. And we notice our habit to want to flee it or fix it or check out. And we see if we can find just that little piece of us that can just surrender, just be. And as we find our way to do that, we find that a kind of a transformation does take place. Something becomes more burnished, more sturdy. We find a larger space that's available to us where we can be out of the, not out of, but not always subject to the intense winds of emotional states, but rather in a place of watching that rise and fall. And as we bear witness to that rising and falling, it kind of naturally and organically can lead us to, you know, a bigger question of, you know, who is this suffering self? Who is this person who is subject to these storms? These intense patterns of habitual response, of just what can feel like unending attacks or evasions. We start to see the ways that we hold our heart as hard. And we wonder, you know, who is this person? And that then it becomes a bigger question. Something bigger starts to happen. You know, I want to talk just a minute. I've been reading and teaching about the relationship between trauma and meditation lately. And I wanted to say a few things about that because I think it is related to the heart of the one who asks. And this woman's heart was traumatized. She had lost her, it sounds like, a very beloved husband at a very young age, we could imagine, unexpectedly. And one way or another, I would say that we all have some trauma that we bring to our meditation practice. For some of us, it's like a capital T trauma, you know, like a terrible thing that happened or a bunch of terrible stuff that happened. And for some of us, it's more, you know, kind of low grade, what I would think of as like relational trauma, you know, childhood stuff, even if you had a pretty good childhood, you know, the things that just accumulate, the things that happen. And what happens when we sit down is that a lot of that comes up. And so to one degree or another, many of us are dealing with some kind of a traumatic state when we sit down to meditate. And it can be helpful just to start to recognize if that's true for you, and if it is true, in what sort of way it's true. It tends to be there's two main ways that this can show up, you know, trauma. And this is a gross oversimplification of something that is, you know, fairly complex. But one way that we respond to a trauma is to hyper-react. We get overstimulated. So we get very emotional. We get very agitated. or very, you know, our thoughts go wild. You know, we can, it can happen in different ways, but our whole system is sort of dysregulated and overstimulated. And it feels like it's hard to settle. It feels like something is out of control, something can feel chaotic, in whatever sort of system of the body-mind that takes place. And, you know, many people, when we come to meditation, you know, we struggle with this. We struggle with overwhelming states of one kind or another. And when that's happening, you know, the most skillful thing is to really keep it simple, keep it breath-focused, grounded, slow, you know, to really just slow down and simplify. The other thing that we can bring to meditation is a tendency to check out, to escape. We can be really dissociate. We can use meditation, and meditation is a great way to pretend that you're meditating, but you're actually just checked out. You know, that's possible. A way to escape difficult feelings, a way to sort of try to cultivate something that looks like, you know, a deep meditative state, but maybe something, you know, that's more of a defense, more of a way of keeping difficulty at bay. And, you know, sometimes in meditation this can be sort of a chronic stuckness or a flatness, or, you know, just really chronic kind of sleepiness or laxness or kind of apathy, just sort of feeling not engaged. So, you know, it can be helpful just to be able to recognize if, you know, something like this is happening in our heart, you know, as we're practicing. So, you know, really this first gate, the gate of the heart of the one who asks is Zen, is the gate of using our emotional life as a way, first to tolerate what happens to us emotionally, to tolerate our experience, to accept and even start to love, you know, and find compassion for our experience, which then naturally extends out. It spreads, it can't help it. You know, it's just its nature. It bleeds. And that's where, you know, we get into this bigger question of, you know, whose suffering is this anyway? This isn't just mine. We start to really notice that. You know, I do not corner the market on grief. Or aging, or sickness, or loss. You know, that's why we're here. We're all in it together. And that just expands the heart, you know, and that heart gets really big. And it leads to this feeling, you know, we call bodhicitta, you know, the aspiration to awaken for all beings, not just for ourselves. You know, it's that heart of just a sort of a natural compassion. It's not something we ever have to try to force. It just happens naturally when we see things as they really are. So this process of transformation, of alchemy, requires a vessel. And in the koan, you know, we have a bucket, which is sort of the archetypal cauldron. Mm-hmm. You know, the witch's kettle, the vessel in which a transformational process happens. And in any good alchemical process, there is a need for a sturdy cauldron. And of course, at first, the bucket is just that. It holds the water so perfectly. You know, in the moon, and there it is, how lovely, the moon perfectly held in the bucket. And as we gather here today, over the last day, we're forming our own cauldron, our own container. You know, a vessel that is strong and sturdy enough to hold our transformation, our alchemy. Because we rely on each other, we're creating a field of all of our practice. So many years of practice in here, so much love, so much care, and we're knitting and weaving it together into a field that can hold anything for any of us. And that's an amazing blessing to have that together. Of course, any good vessel is made to be broken. And the bottom does fall out of the bucket. But I'm interested in a certain moment in the koan where the teacher actually changes his approach. His first teaching was the heart of the one who asks is Zen. So then she has, you know, she hears the deer and she, you know, has some kind of an opening and writes this poem, which he glances at, right? And then he offers his second teaching, which is different. Read the Heart Sutra. So he's still on about the heart. But read the Heart Sutra has a different feel for, you know, what's in your heart. So what's up with that? And what does the Heart Sutra have to do with the heart anyway? You know, the Heart Sutra is probably the most well-known Buddhist teaching on, you know, what we call emptiness, which is kind of a difficult word, but maybe we could call it, instead of just using that word emptiness, we could call it interdependence. We could call it transitoriness. We could call it sort of lack of any separate individual being. You know, so there's no separation. Emptiness sounds kind of like a void, and that's really not what this is about. It's about a feeling of no separation, no dualism. And so in this sense, the Heart Sutra is talking about sort of our most fundamental heart, you know, not just our personal heart, our personal story, but a heart that's so much bigger than that, the heart that we share, that's so much bigger than anything that we can imagine. It's the heart that happens when the bottom does drop out of the bucket. So the practice of the Heart Sutra, you know, is really the practice of seeing things as they really are, which is not dual, not two. Whatever you think, not no. It's the practice of no, of negation, of pulling the rug out from under. And in the course of doing that, you know, what is revealed is just, you know, a tremendous awareness of, because we're so interconnected, that we cannot not feel our heart is so much bigger than that any one of our individual hearts. And that when we can really feel that and really share that awareness, it's such a relief. You know, we don't have to carry it alone. We don't have to be a superhero. We don't have to figure it out. You know, we don't have to just be really good. We don't have to even be good meditators, thank goodness. You know, we can just feel the unfolding of, you know, of the the heart that we share. So that moment where Bhukko changed his teaching was a moment after the student had written this poem that I read as a little staid, right? She's gotten this little bit of insight, and so she's sort of got her, she's preciously holding her bucket and her moon, and everything's kind of careful and balanced, and it all looks really nice. But so, of course, you know, it needs to be upended. And so that's his prescription, you know. Okay, so now you have had contact with the heart of the one who asks. Now let's pull the rug out from under that. And it points to a place in our practice when we do need to do the necessary personal healing, and we also need to know when we're getting stuck in something about that, and we need to upend that. And how the skillful means is to not do that prematurely, because that's a way that we can use to skip things that we don't like. But also to start to recognize, and this is where it's really helpful to have teachers and spiritual friends, you know, when we're getting stuck in a sort of an emotional dead end, which it seems like maybe she had gotten into a little bit with that first poem. Just one reading. So the natural emotional response to an awareness of interdependence, which is the teaching of the Heart Sutra, the teaching of emptiness, when you see that, the emotional response is just naturally one of compassion. And that feeling of compassion is sort of a universal solvent. You know, it's whatever it comes into contact with, it softens. Whatever pain you have, whatever loss you have, whatever grief you have, whatever joy you have, you know, bringing an awareness of compassion to it will make it so much richer and deeper and broader. And that's, you know, the transformation of the koan. So part of the koan way is that the koans help us develop what I think of as binocular vision. So it's like we're seeing through two eyes at the same time, just like with binoculars. And with one eye, we keep our eye on the heart of the one who asks, your heart. You know, in its particularity, in its poignancy, in its vulnerability, you know, in its confusion, and exactly as it is. One eye trained on that with a lot of curiosity and kindness. And then the other eye is the Heart Sutra eye, you know, the big picture. You know, the awareness of our interdependence, an awareness that we're so much bigger than our personal sorrow. And when we can see at the same time through each of those eyes, you know, that both things are true, we don't have to choose. We really don't. We can actually really, in our practice, be with the heart, your heart, the heart of the one who asks. And also with the vast heart, the heart of the Heart Sutra, the heart of emptiness. And not in a cold way, in a very warm-hearted way. And that's how practice becomes mature and develops a texture, you know, a depth, sort of like that nubbiness, you know, like in a good fabric, you know, where there's something interesting going on. The weave isn't just all one thing. You know, there's weird glitches and colors and ways things come together and a beautiful sheen, and it all, you know, weaves together. And that's that's a practice of the heart that I think is sort of a true practice. It's you know, in the last poem, the later poet talks about the humble woman's bucket. You know, and I think that that's one of the qualities that, that this kind of practice can give rise to, is just that quality of humility. Because, you know, sure, we can have insights and practice, but it doesn't make us better. In fact, what it makes us aware of is, you know, just welcome to the human race. You know, we're all in it together. You know, that nose hole society. So yes, that humble woman, and you know, our humble practice and our sincere practice and our practice of the heart. Well, I think I'll stop there. If there are any thoughts or questions, I welcome that.
I just really like that you brought together the two hearts, and it really has me thinking about sitting with that, you know, my heart and the vast heart, and the Heart Sutra, and see what's there.
I felt like, I loved this, Megan, and I felt like when from the very first one, the teacher says the heart of the one who asks is Zen. I thought, wow, you know, she can't own that all by herself. Mm-hmm. The minute you say it's Zen, mm-hmm. because all of a sudden I felt, you know, the whole world of Zen coming into her heart and being her heart. So it just was the minute he answered her that, it just opened up everything to her heart belonging to everybody, and everybody sharing that same heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Makes such a big difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
The question, who hears, has always been one of my favorite Joan things. And I see how that transitions into the question, who suffers? Mm-hmm. Who is that? Mm-hmm. And I was actually suffering here at this retreat, and had the opportunity to share my heart of suffering with all the other people, even if they weren't particularly suffering at this same time in the same way as I was. And it was just so opening, so incredibly opening to be able to do that. Because who is this sufferer anyway?
Right. Right. Yeah, that becomes an interesting question. Right. It's different from just staying on the roller coaster of suffering, but to say, wait a minute, what's going on? Who is that?
For question. Mm-hmm. So when suffering has been laid down long ago, resprouts. Any guidance on, and maybe you're in a place where you're not re-spewing all that. But there's, I think, a line in there of containing it, Sounds a problem already. and sharing it, and sharing it in such a way that you aren't burdening others. But yet, you know, it seems like maybe a lack of trust in that other person of being able to share it with you. So do you have any guidance on that? Does that make sense?
So it's really about an old wound that you thought was sort of laid to rest?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You know, it's...
It's tough to make sense of that because it doesn't make sense.
But, you know, that's the trick, is that what we tend to do with quote-unquote problems, which we tend to label anything that we don't like as a problem, right, is we try to figure it out. Why is this happening? Right? This is supposed to be done. I'm supposed to be done with this particular thing. You know, and it's and what happens is then an aggression towards it. Towards the feeling of I don't want you, I'm done with you, you know, and what's the problem here? Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that becomes a contracted way of relating to the state, you know, which seems to need some kind of open-hearted reception. Usually that's what, you know, our real kind of the tender emotions, like the, you know, there's so many different kinds of emotions. Some of them are just like habitual reactive ones, you know, the ones that just where you just fly into a rage, you know, automatically at a certain point in time. But then there's some that are more sort of like tender, or they feel kind of young or like really raw, you know, those. And, you know, those can be hard to be with.
There's some intersection that I'm exploring with this all, because sometimes the earlier part of Mujaku's life feels like I would hear this unselfing of self, but there's something even more, you know, the old stories that seems like you could light a match and. You know, you're all of a sudden in a different terrain entirely.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a millisecond where you go, you know, and it ignites a whole different world.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very curious about that.
When the bottom drops out.
Yeah, exactly.
Uh-huh. Yeah, right. Right, you know, and you know, what happened for the 10 years before that, right? Because what we don't dwell on in the koan is that it says... take the Heart Sutra and go. After that, she had interviews with the teacher, coming and being sent away. Until in the end, the bottom fell out of the bucket. There was a lot that happened. We just cut straight to the chase there. Yeah. Because we like that story. You know, we have those moments, right? We have the moments of the bottom falling out. And it's a beautiful thing. And you can't strive for it, right? That's the trick. Or you can try. I mean, we all do. Like, have fun. Go at it. Good luck.
So Megan, it sounds like the who hears can be the capital W and the small W, but it seems like if you try to identify it, you've lost it.
The who?
The who.
Mm-hmm. Well, right, so, you know, this is a different, instead of who hears, it's who who's grief-stricken, who's enraged, who's confused.
Yeah, and, you know, the big who and the little who and the who. You know what I'm saying, that movement, that dance between the two that you really don't want to pin down, maybe?
Right, that's the binoculars, right? Mm-hmm. Just to have one eye on each part of that.
Uh-huh.
You know, and to not have to pin it down. You don't ever have to resolve it. That's the beauty.
Uh-huh.
That's the trick in Zen, is you never have to choose.
Okay.
You never, you know, that you can always hold the multiplicity, and that's so relieving.
Question about how to feel the emotion without attaching a story, because I feel like that's where the emotions come from, the story or something.
Well, so that's an interesting question, is which comes first? It's like a chicken and the egg, right? Because they do tend to co-arise. And I think, you know, for most of us who sit for any length of time, you get kind of caught up and mired in your story and your habitual emotions. And so you can start to kind of slow it down and pay attention. You know, what is that moment where something... Joan used to call it the moment before, you know, that moment when you can sort of, something habitual starts to happen and you can almost like back up a half a step and say, oh, look at what's happening. Mm-hmm. You know, and then you can see, oh, the story that comes with that is, I'm a loser. Mm-hmm. No one will ever love me. Or the reason I'm unhappy is because of my mother. You know, whatever your, you know, we all have our sort of versions of our stories, you know, that tend to be, you know, they just run in a loop. Mm-hmm. So we can just start to unhook it. It's like they don't have to be hooked together. They tend to co-arise habitually. But this is like part, this is the kind of karmic burn-off part of practice. So we can start to unhook, untether the energetic state of emotions. And you know, and emotions are physical too, right? Because mm-hmm. there's like, they can be so much in the body, and the heart, and the gut, and the spine, and the head. You know, we all have, I think, have those feelings in practice of just like some energetic knot, like gets clenched or released. You know, we don't even know what it is. We don't need to know, but something happens.
So, you know, Freud talks about working through, right? You know, mm-hmm. and you just talked about karmic burn off. Mm-hmm. So could you talk a little bit about kind of what meditation brings to the table, you know, the way in which meditation is a resource that supplements what could happen in psychoanalysis or therapy?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So for those who don't know, I'm a psychologist and psychoanalyst, so I kind of work this from various sides. And, you know, the short version is that what often, I mean, it depends, there's so many kinds of therapy, so many kinds of meditation, it's hard to generalize, really. But if I were to try, you know, often what therapy is about is making sense of our suffering, developing a narrative that makes sense, you know, and that's really important. You know, that it's not just because I'm crazy or bad that I suffer, you know, but there's a reason for it, and it makes sense, and I was responding as best I could to some kind of difficult situation, you know, and that can be really healing. And the approach, I think, of meditation to difficult emotions is different than that, in that we are not very interested in meaning. We're not interested in the story. It's not because it's not important. It's a different task, you know. It's a task of, that's why a lot of people find that it's really great to be in therapy and meditate both. It's just kind of different tasks, different angles, you know. And the task of meditation really with emotions is to work with them more energetically and to see if it's possible to let go of the really habitual storyline. Not even let it go, just see it for what it is, right? It's like spam. That's what it is. You get spam in your inbox. Do you open it? No. Do you buy the product? No. So this is like that. You know, we just don't have to open that spam. We just say delete. Right? And it gets to be a little easier. We don't have to go to that old tale of woe. You know?
So you are describing working with emotions energetically as a kind of a gateway, and if we can separate the story from that process, how does that work? A gateway to awakening, a vehicle, is the work about keeping the energy flowing, keeping things moving?
The way I see it, it's just never a linear path. It's sort of, you know, more like all over the place, right? But it can be a gate. There are moments, especially when we have the great good fortune to sit in the session, you know, where things do get simpler and really still. And we can have that moment of just like we're stepping into the big heart, you know, effortlessly. And it's just right there, of course, you know. And then we're right, then the next hour, and then we're like, oh my God, look, how cool is this? And then the next hour is just like we're back into our petty, you know, irritable, judgmental thing. We're like, what happened? You know, I had it all figured out. So that's the path, right?
Stepping into the big heart. That's yeah. That's a great phrase. Uh-huh. A great way to put it.
Yeah, and then right back out. Right? But it's that, you know, again, it's just like... It's just amusing. It's just fun. You know, you can just watch like, oh God, here I go. It's still crazy after all these years, you know.
There's something comforting about going, well, this is just what it means to be human.
Right.
You
know? Exactly.
Yeah.
I have a question. I've been kind of practicing just being okay with whatever
it is.
But, and that's been a few years. But lately I feel like maybe that is itself spiritual bypassing. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
So, you know, I think it's a great question for all of us to always ask ourselves, really, is how am I spiritually bypassing or am I? Because we can use things pretty subtly. So I don't know for you in this case, but if what we're doing is sort of cultivating a kind of equanimity, mm-hmm. like, you know, it's all good with me, peace out, kind of thing, that can feel like that's a bypass. Mm-hmm. That's like sort of avoiding the difficulty. Because there's a level at which, you know, we can say, yes, I can accept things as they are. But if that means that we're going to say, well, everything is just fine with me all the time and I don't have feelings.
Right, you're like suppressing those feelings.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's that subtle mm-hmm. inquiry. Yeah. Inquiry of the heart is, what am I, what's the edge, the vulnerability of the heart that I'm maybe wanting to close down?
Mm-hmm. That suddenly reminded me of that koan where the man who's desperately unhappy comes to the teacher who says, thank you for everything. I have nothing to complain about. Just do that. Just say that. And while that could sound exactly like spiritual bypassing, what if it isn't? What about when it isn't? You know, what about when it's putting you right exactly at that edge you're talking about. Mm-hmm. About really? Okay, what is it to be okay with it while your heart is pounding, or, you know, while you're getting hot and your hairs are rising on the back of your neck? You know? And what is that? So as Megan, you were saying, what if you don't have to choose one or the other?
Exactly.
Yeah. Just keep looking more deeply at it.
Yeah, and let it get bigger.
Yeah.
You know, let it just... Yeah, I was thinking
let
with this...
Huh? Let it fester.
Do you guys remember the original Grinch Who Stole Christmas? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And at the end, like, they have his little minuscule little heart, and they have a magnifying glass, and it kind of busts out of three different sizes of magnifying glass because his heart grows bigger. I always think of that. You know, we can just bust it out. You know, it's like the bottom dropping out of the bucket. You know, our heart can just get bigger, and that's that move usually feels like a big relief.
Yeah. And that I have nothing to complain about has that sort of feeling to me of an expander, mm-hmm. kind of, because you get to look at, I was just feeling like complaining, you know, at this moment I was just feeling like it's all targeting me somehow. And, mm-hmm.
Lonnie?
Sort of getting the feeling, you know, that the thing about maybe and tell me if I've got this right, or the thing about dealing energetically with just the feeling is that the feelings come and go.
Right.
So if you're not feeding them with the story,
right,
you know, you're not adding fuel,
right,
in that way. And even if it's really painful, you start to realize it doesn't last that long.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and the thing is, we have this fear of emotional, yeah, states. We have this fear that I'll get stuck there and I'll feel that forever.
Right.
Right? That's our fear of feeling, often of our feeling grief or sadness or fear, is that it seems like it's just infinite, right? That if I go there, I'll be subsumed and sort of somehow just, you know, stuck in an infinite sea of pain. But so when we actually become willing to show up for the energy of it, one of the big things that we can start to notice is that's not actually true.
It's so funny because I think what happens is I think, oh, I've been here before. This really doesn't feel good. Why does it keep coming back?
Right.
Instead of realizing it goes away.
Yeah.
I mean, all the times it's gone away, I'm coming back to, oh, shit, it's here again. You know? Sort of interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hyper reaction to, yeah, the pain.
Martha was going to say. I don't know if this is a comment or a question. We'll see. I have to say that, you know, I practiced for a lot of years thinking that I was practicing compassion, and it, you know, it wasn't until I tried doing therapy that I realized I was extending it to others and never to myself. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you might have any comments about how we recognize that and engage it. You know, that's right where my practice is right now.
Right.
And yeah, it's really exciting and wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I can't get over what a big long years of blind spot it was.
Right. Right. I mean, I think it is so for so many people, you know? It seems hard to, it can seem hard to actually allow ourselves to experience that compassion for ourselves it's not optional. It's the needed first spot. You can't skip that. You don't go to compassion for other people without starting with a foundation of compassion for self, because then you don't have no ground to stand on. It's false. You know, it's sort of, it's got this quality of something more like sympathy than compassion, you know? Mm. Something that's, it's not grounded, it's not rooted in a feeling of our, just like, yeah, this is just what it is to be human. I'm here too.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I think when you said that thing about, when we get a little aggressive toward the emotion itself, I think that really felt like that very spot of, that's when compassion isn't coming towards,
right,
self.
Right, and that's, you know, and then we just have to always have, you know, say, okay, what's the next level of compassion I need to find?
Because
sometimes we have to just find further and further. It's like, oh God, wow, here's another thing that needs a whole lot of compassion. Any final thoughts? Thank you all.
Thank you.